The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
She's got the news. She talks with newsmakers. She encourages us to laugh, and she cries with us. Speaking truth to power and questioning authority daily, it's the Nicole Sandler Show.
It is. Hold on. It's a Tuesday. Wow. Today's Tuesday. I was going to say, this week feels like it is just plodding along, and it is. It's only Tuesday. And everything is just inside out and upside down, and nothing makes sense, I got to tell you. I don't even know where to begin. I guess I could start with the most recent news, which is that the state of Texas, yeah, Governor Greg Abbott, you know, who did such a great job in helping the people of his state through a cold spell a couple of weeks ago. I'm being facetious there. Well, today, Greg Abbott announced that come Wednesday, he's doing away with the any COVID mitigation measures. As of Wednesday, everything in Texas can open up at 100%. And oh, yeah, no more mask mandate. What? The CDC, the FDA, Dr. Fauci, everybody involved says now is not the time to ease up on efforts to stop the spread. So what does he do? He goes ahead and does that. And then because, you know, they don't want to be upstaged by Texas, Mississippi did the same thing. I think it was Mississippi. There are no words. It just the lack of responsibility on behalf of these Republicans is astounding, because they don't want to admit that on this, at least. And believe me, my pleasure with Joe Biden is waning a little bit more with each passing day. We can get into some of that a little later, too. But no, the governors of Texas and Mississippi announced today that they are lifting their state's mask mandates and rolling back all of their COVID-19 health mandates just one day after the CDC warned against complacency in the face of emerging coronavirus variants. So, you know, I do give the Biden administration some credit in that they're making progress. In fact, in case you didn't see it, Joe Biden just really moments ago made this announcement, and it's pretty groundbreaking.
We're now on track to have enough vaccine supply for every adult in America by the end of May.
Wow.
Let me say that again. When we came into office, the prior administration had contracted for not nearly enough vaccine to cover adults in America.
Yep.
We rectified that. About 3 weeks ago, we were able to say that we'll have enough vaccine supply for adults by the end of July.
Oh, okay.
And I'm pleased to announce today, as a consequence of the stepped-up process that I've ordered and just outlined, this country will have enough vaccine supply, I'll say it again, for every adult in America by the end of May. By the end of May. That's progress, important progress.
Yeah, it is. And you know what? I'm grateful for one. But, you know, I've already had my first vaccine. I get my second one on March 24th. I'm literally counting the days because I want to be able to get back to life somewhat normally. Right. I want to be able to go out. I want to go to the beach. I want to hug my kid. But and at this point, you know what? If it all ended for me today, that would be fine. The one thing I don't want is to be sick with COVID because it's horrendous. It's horrific. When people get really sick, there are some people who are asymptomatic. And I would have said, oh, those are the lucky ones. Until a news item I saw last night. That some people who have had COVID but were asymptomatic are dying. because it's so new. The doctors, the scientists don't know what kind of harm it causes in your body. You know what? If I could just fall asleep and not wake up, well, I was going to say I'd be happy with it, but you know, I wouldn't know because I'd be dead. I just don't want to go through a long, painful, debilitating illness. And I'll do anything I can to avoid that. Death is going to come. Yeah, it's inevitable. Getting sick, we can avoid that. But these idiots, you know, I watched a compilation of some of the interviews done with some of the people who were at CPAC this weekend. And these people are fucking nuts. The naysayers are crazy. And that just the stuff that they're doing makes no sense. So there was important things that happened today. We're going to go over some of them. There was a Supreme Court case. Actually, two rolled into one. You heard about it yesterday. If you listened to the show yesterday, I had an interview with Ian Millhiser of Vox.com, who covers the courts, covers that. And he warned us that the Supreme Court today was going to hear these two cases that could put the final nail in the coffin of the Voting Rights Act. Voting Rights Act shouldn't be in a coffin. The Voting Rights Act should be the law of the land, should protect our vote, should make it easier for you and me to vote. But because Democrats won in November in a lot of places, hello, Donald Trump, thank you very much, many of the states that are still controlled by Republican state legislatures and Republican governors, hello, Georgia, for example, are putting in the most prohibitive voting laws aimed at keeping you from voting. Voter suppression laws is what they are. And it's astounding what's going on. I mentioned yesterday what they passed in Georgia. It went through the Georgia House. I don't know if it's cleared the Georgia Senate yet, but basically, and it's nothing new. It's not only unique to Georgia. This has happened, I think, in something like 35 states already just since the November elections, where, but I'll use Georgia for an example because it's top of mind. And here in Florida, where the legislative session, which goes for 2 months, just opened today, and they're trying to push through some of these voter suppression bills. In other words, like here in Florida, for years, I have voted absentee. It was anybody could. All you had to do was, you know, say that you wanted one and your request was good for 2 years. And for every election, your ballot would show up in the mailbox. And then when the 2 years was up, you'd get a reminder asking if you wanted to continue it. So I've been voting absentee for probably 10 years now. No longer, because they're trying to fix what's not broken and make it so that no, for every election you have to request a mail-in ballot. In Georgia, they're even making it more prohibitive. They're doing away with no fault absentee voting or whatever. You didn't have to prove a necessary medical need or something. Now you do. So if you're just old and, you know, infirm, or you don't have access to public transportation, or you work three jobs to make ends meet and you can't take a day off to go vote, no longer can you have the convenience of voting absentee. So what happened in today's Supreme Court hearing? Well, your guess is as good as mine. I listened to some of it. I actually had to go get blood drawn this morning for a test. But so I wasn't glued to the computer all day and I'm doing other work. But so I read, you know, first place I looked was to see what Ian Millhiser wrote, because, you know, we spoke with him yesterday. Actually, it was Friday, but you get the idea. And so I figured he's the one who set it up for us. Let's see how he says it all came out on the other end today. And the headline at Vox.com on his article reads, "The Voting Rights Act had a surprisingly good day at the Supreme Court." And then the subtitle is, "If the Voting Rights Act survives this latest challenge, thank bad lawyering on the GOP side." Great. And I will link to the article so you can. I was going to read the whole thing, but frankly, it's legalese and my eyes tend to roll back in my head. And it's a long article, so I'm not going to bore you with all of the details. I will link to it so you can read it. It's from the blog. It'll be posted along with the podcast at NicoleSandler.com/3-2-21. And the end of it, let me just, I'll cut to the chase. We'll go right to the end. And he writes, the bottom line is that there's a good chance that Arizona's restrictions on ballot collection and out-of-precinct voting will be upheld. So these two laws that went all the way to the Supreme Court, that in two areas that they were trying to keep you from voting easily. One was if you went to the wrong precinct to vote, they'll just throw out the entire ballot. Instead of letting the votes that apply to that precinct, and really the only person, the only race that it wouldn't, the most hyper partisan, I mean the hyper local races, but one, so the one case would throw out the ballots of anyone who voted in the wrong precinct. The other one, what did he say? The restrictions on ballot collection. That is, it restricts who can collect ballots and bring them in. So, for instance, you know, here, well, my daughter doesn't live here anymore, but it used to be I'd fill out my ballot, Allison would fill out hers, David would fill out his, and he'd bring all three of them to the supervisor of elections office and drop them off. And on a larger scale, you know, the drop boxes, for instance, you can put everything in a drop box and somebody would pick that up and bring it to the election headquarters. Donald Trump called that ballot harvesting. They're saying that those would be, they're challenging the legality of that. So that's what the gist of those two cases that were heard today in the Supreme Court were about. And again, Ian Millhiser writes, the bottom line is that there's a good chance that the Arizona's restrictions on those two cases will be upheld. And he writes, and there's even a good chance that the court will take a significant bite out of the Voting Rights Act in one of the cases, the Brnovich. But then he writes, but going by today's arguments, at least, the full-scale attack on the act proposed by Garvin and Brnovich, these two cases, seems less likely. Such an attack may still come in the future, but Garvin and Brnovich's ham-handed lawyering left the justices little to work with if they hope to dismantle the results test right now. So, if Ian Millhiser if his take on what happened at the court this morning is correct, they're going to keep whittling away at the Voting Rights Act piece by piece by piece by piece till they get it all. Here's what's got me so crazy. There are more of us than there are of them. By us and them, I'm using the big picture Democrats, even though I know a lot of us don't consider ourselves Democrats anymore. There's more progressives. There's more people on the right. I'm sorry, I can only couch it in these terms. On the right side of things than there are the Neanderthals on the right. I should use correct instead of right in this instance. It makes no sense. Just like Texas and Mississippi saying, you know what? Yeah, screw the protection. Just everybody do whatever you want. 500,000 dead isn't enough for you? I'm over it. I'm just over it. I know this is not, you know. Then today, so today is, what's the name of the, it's like a reading is fundamental day or something like that. It also happens to be Dr. Seuss's birthday, and that's the reason that today is this reading holiday, quasi holiday of sorts. So today, the Seuss Foundation, here, let me pull up my notes because I don't want to get this wrong. The Dr. Seuss, I want to make sure I have it, Enterprises, DSE, Dr. Seuss Enterprises. It's the organization that handles all the Dr. Seuss books, his estate, everything having to do with Dr. Seuss. Months ago, Dr. Seuss Enterprises made a decision to stop publishing six older Dr. Seuss titles due to some of the drawings, the illustrations in the book that look, you know, are a bit racist. They're outdated. It's a sign of the times. So here's some examples in case you're wondering. There was a book called And to Think That I Saw It on Mulberry Street. Yeah, it's not exactly Green Eggs and Ham. It's not a household Dr. Seuss book, right? In that book, an Asian person is portrayed wearing a conical hat, holding chopsticks, and eating from a bowl. In another one called If I Ran the Zoo, there's a drawing of two barefooted African men wearing what appear to be grass skirts with their hair tied above their heads. That's the kind of stuff they're going, you know what, this isn't necessary. And it's not like they're taking Green Eggs and Ham or Cat in the Hat out of circulation. Random House Children Books, Dr. Seuss's publisher, issued a brief statement today that said, "We respect the decision of Dr. Seuss Enterprises and the work of the panel that reviewed this content last year and their recommendations." That's where this came from. This had nothing to do with the Democrats or the left or Congress or anyone other than Dr. Seuss Enterprises. You got that, right? If you turn on Fox today or Newsmax, I'm guessing, or OAN for that matter, I wouldn't know because I don't go there. This is all they're talking about. Aaron Rupar is going to join us later on in the hour. Aaron Rupar is a reporter for Vox, not Fox, but Vox, as is Ian Millhiser. And he does, and part of his beat is the crazy Republicans. So I invited him on because I honestly, I really felt sorry for him over the weekend. I did not. My TV did not go to CPAC. I did not watch it. However, Aaron Rupar did, and he's constantly watching, pulling video of the insanity that goes on over there. And so today, let me see if I can pull up one of his posts talking about the sideshow going on. And I don't even want to call them conservative media because they're not conservative. It's right wing crazy media. That's who they are. That's what they are. And they have gone overboard, all they're posting about. I mean, every story they do is about the cancellation of Dr. Seuss. Here, a tweet from Aaron Rupar from a few hours ago. The purported cancellation of Dr. Seuss has been mentioned at least 32 times on Fox News and Fox Business already this morning. He posted this morning at, I think, 10 o'clock. It was mentioned 22 times on Newsmax's morning show. For context, COVID was mentioned 11 times on Fox and Friends, as opposed to 32, and 12 times on Newsmax's morning show. COVID, 12. Dr. Seuss canceled 22. And they're blaming Nancy Pelosi. I mean, it's, you know, I talk about opposite world all the time, but this goes beyond that. It's just plain astounding. It makes no sense, but this is where so much of today's Republican Party is. I just don't know. I'm at a loss. There was a hearing, you know, they're starting to debate the COVID relief bill. I forget what they're calling it, but whatever. Kevin McCarthy, as you know, is the House Minority Leader. This man wants to be Speaker of the House, right? The only thing standing in his way right now, I guess, is Nancy Pelosi. So in the debate whatever committee it was, over the COVID relief bill, the $1.9 trillion bill that will help Americans, listen to what Kevin McCarthy said.
H.R. 1 rewrites election law and imposes a one-size-fits-all partisan rules from Washington. Under the Constitution, we generally defer to states and counties to run elections. Democrats want to change that. First, they outlaw Dr. Seuss.
What?
And now they want to tell us what to say.
We outlawed Dr. Seuss? I mean, where do they get this stuff? It's like they sit in a little echo chamber room and they recycle the bullshit. It's just, you know, I found out the new theme song for the Republican Party. I can't play too much of it because I don't want to get copyright violated. But you know the song. You can sing along. It's just this one part of it. Lie, lie, lie. Lie, 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 lie. Lie, 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 lie. That's it. It goes like that. Lie, 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 lie. So the Supreme Court thing went, oh, let me just play you one clip from the Supreme Court argument where one of the lawyers from one of the Arizona cases actually said the quiet part out loud again. And it was actually Amy Coney Barrett who asked the question. And if you listen to her ask the question, you'll see why I do this voice every time I say her name, because that's how she sounds.
What's the interest of the Arizona RNC here in keeping, say, the out-of-precinct ballot disqualification rules on the books?
Yeah.
Because it puts us at a competitive disadvantage relative to Democrats.
Oh.
Politics is a zero-sum game.
Oh.
And every extra vote they get through unlawful interpretations of Section 2 hurts us. It's the difference between winning an election 50-49 and losing an election.
Okay, thank you. My time is up.
Okay, thank you. My time is up. I think she inhales the helium right before she speaks. Or there's a problem with the voice box controller. Then it makes her talk like this. It's just how she sounds. I can't help it. Anyway, so he said, why are we interested in this? Because if they're allowed to vote and have their votes counted, it puts us at a disadvantage. Yeah, I just don't know. All right. Then that happened this morning. Also going on today. FBI Director Christopher Wray was testifying. He testified on what happened on January 6th. There were some really interesting exchanges here that I think I should share with you. Hold on, let me bring up the right page here. All right, so for instance, here's Chris Wray talking about what he would call. What happened on the 6th?
Attack.
Yeah.
That siege was criminal behavior,
yeah.
Plain and simple. And it's behavior that we, the FBI, view as domestic terrorism.
Domestic terrorism.
It's got no place in our democracy.
Hmm.
And tolerating it would make a mockery of our nation's rule of law.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
the rule of law, of course, is our country's bedrock, and it's our guiding principle at the FBI. That's why the FBI has been working day and night across the country to track down those responsible for the events of January 6th and to hold them accountable. We're chasing down leads. We're reviewing evidence, combing through digital media to identify, investigate, and arrest anyone who broke the law that day.
Good, as you should.
And our greatest partner in this investigation has been the American people themselves, your constituents. Citizens from around the country have sent us more than 270,000 digital media tips. Some have even taken the painful step of turning in their friends or their family members. But with their help, we've identified hundreds of suspects and opened hundreds of investigations in all but one of our 56 field offices. And of those identified, we've arrested already more than 270 individuals to date. Over 300 when you include the ones of our partners, with more subjects being identified.
But there were thousands there that day, just saying.
The FBI is committed to seeing this through, no matter how many people it takes or how long or the resources we need to get it done.
Okay.
Because as citizens, in a sense, we're all victims of the January 6th assault.
In a sense?
And the American people deserve nothing less.
You think? In a sense. All right. So there's a little bit of that. Now, he made it very clear.
And I understand from your testimony previously that you did not see Antifa or left-wing groups playing a
left-wing groups.
Role
no left-wing
in the
groups.
January 6th insurrection.
Certainly, while we're equal opportunity and looking for violent extremism of any ideology, we have not to date seen any evidence of anarchist violent extremists or people subscribing to Antifa in connection with the 6th. That doesn't mean we're not looking, and we'll continue to look. But okay. At the moment, we have not seen that.
Two things here. First of all, Antifa does not exist. There are anti-fascist citizens. I'm one. I'm against fascism. There are some who are more active than others, but there's no organization called Antifa. Like, apparently there is an organization called the Proud Boys. There is the Oath Keepers. There are the Boogaloo Boys. There is QAnon. Go figure, even though Tucker Carlson says there isn't. But for him to even use the term is wrong, number one, and to equate anarchists with that movement. I'm sorry, anarchists are people who have no use for government. Don't call them leftists. They're anarchists. They're in a class all by themselves. But that's the problem, because they tend to bunch them all together with us. But again, he said it.
So in your investigation so far, do you have any evidence that the Capitol attack was organized by, quote, fake Trump protesters?
We have not seen evidence of that at this stage, certainly.
We have not seen evidence of that. But that doesn't stop them from saying it, because what they do on the right is...
Lie, lie, lie.
Lie, lie, lie.
Lie, lie, lie.
Lie, 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 lie. Okay, you get the idea. There's more. Let's see. What else? What else? Oh, but, you know, not all of the senators were so willing to let bygones be bygones with Christopher Wray, who, by the way, you know, was he ascended to the director of the FBI under Donald Trump. And Sheldon Whitehouse, for one, wants to let him know that he remembers how he acted under Trump.
Senator, I commit to working with you to try and see how we can improve our responsiveness and to getting you more of the information you need. The one thing I will say is that I can assure you that in terms of my responsiveness to this committee, to the members of this committee, or to Congress overall, it is absolutely not, speaking only for myself now, mm-hmm. on a partisan basis.
Right.
Well, you run an organization that seems to have operated under very different rules, and it was you running that organization. So let's not make these distinctions right now.
Yeah.
Thanks, Senator.
Yeah, that was the end of it. There was actually a longer clip. Here it is. All right. Here's the longer one of White House going off.
How many questions for the record the FBI failed to answer in the last 4 years?
I do not.
Well, I'll tell you.
Okay, you tell us.
Hearings in this committee in which the FBI was a witness, and in 7 of them, the committee got exactly 0 questions for the record. 7.
7.
0 questions.
Wow.
Can you explain that?
I cannot. I will say...
Are you going to do any better with the questions that we're getting right now? You've been asked questions for the record. Are they going to go into the same... whatever it was, hole, where questions for the record go to die at the FBI?
Hole.
Well, Senator, first thing I would say about questions for the record is that, as you may know, there is an elaborate interagency process that requires that answers that we provide have
to be. Which is immensely convenient for the executive branch. But our questions don't direct that interagency process, do they?
Sheldon Whitehouse is not happy right now.
The agency process doesn't respond to us in Congress, does it?
Uh-oh.
We're required to comply with the interagency process to provide our responses to questions for the record.
By what?
Now, having said that,
Are you required to comply with that interagency process?
I can't cite you the reg or the rule.
Mm. Because it seems to me that when the FBI wanted to get information to this committee, particularly when it wanted to get information to Republican members of this committee so they could investigate your investigation of the Trump-Russia connection.
Uh-huh.
That information got right through to our Republican colleagues. It didn't seem to go through any interagency process. It wasn't delayed.
Uh-oh.
What we seem to have is, for most of us, But this was bipartisan, by the way. When I say we got zero questions for the record answered from those hearings, I mean zero questions of any member of this committee, not zero Democratic members answered. Okay? So you've got this basic high.
Okay, so the clip ends there. Sheldon Whitehouse was having none of it, was calling Christopher Wray out on the way that he dealt with the questions asked by the senators during the Trump administration, and basically saying that stuff's going to end now. Whether it does or not, I don't know. What I'm seeing is a lot of pushback on every front. I mean, the lies from the right to the non-answers from officials. I was hoping that once we reached a kinder, gentler era in the post-Trump days, things would get better. I don't know that they are. I think they're just getting a little more crazy. And this is my segue into our next segment. Now, usually at this time, it's Tuesday. Gotta Laugh is usually here. She is suffering from horrible tendonitis. Her hands are just not working now. So she can't do the Twitter thing. So I have enlisted to join us today one of her favorite tweeters and mine. Aaron Rupar is... works for Vox, Vox.com. He's a reporter, an analyst. You find him there, but you also find him on the Twitters. There he is, at A.T. Rupar, where he, Aaron, I give you, first of all, thank you for joining us. Welcome to the show. So nice to meet you in person.
Thanks for having me on.
Oh, it's my pleasure. And actually invited you on, as I was telling the listeners before, after watching your action this weekend. You were nonstop watching CPAC, so we didn't have to. And I hope you get hazard pay for that.
I wish I got hazard pay. I got a day off yesterday. that was my compensation. But I've been covering CPAC now. This was the fourth year I've been doing kind of wall-to-wall coverage. And it doesn't get any less crazy. So, that makes it in some ways kind of easy to cover, but yeah, it's a little bit mentally exhausting at the same time.
Right. Did you think that maybe once, we got Trump out of the White House, that things might start settling down, getting a handle on the pandemic, infection rates are coming down, the vaccine is being distributed, we're seeing maybe some kind of light at the end of the tunnel, that maybe some of the crazy would ease up a little bit, or did you expect it to be as it is now, where just they seem to be going even further off the deep end?
That's a good question. And I feel like I never really felt like it was going to get less crazy because, of course, when you think back what was going on even in November, it was pretty clear that Trump was never going to concede the election, even after it became very clear that he actually lost. And so what that led to was months of the big lie, months of trying to find a way to overturn the results. And, of course, that culminated in the January 6th. Insurrection. And then even after that, there were questions, was Trump going to try to impose martial law or do something, to escalate it even further before leaving office and kind of a last ditch attempt to not leave office. And so there's never really been a moment to come up for air. But, I will say with regard to CPAC specifically, there did seem to be a moment after the insurrection, when Kevin McCarthy gave his speech, kind of distancing himself from Trump. Lindsey Graham, of course, did a number of media appearances and did a speech on the Senate floor, wow, putting some distance between himself and Trump. And so, I did kind of wonder, that week or two, whether this was finally going to be the off ramp that Republicans take to finally put some distance between themselves and Trump. And what CPAC made very clear is that they did not take that off ramp, that this is still very much Trump's party. It was a weekend long celebration of Trump. And, kind of the odd thing that sticks with me is that, there was really kind of this ethos, this assumption that sort of underpinned everything that happened at CPAC, where it was as though Trump won the election. Everybody was just kind of pretending that either Trump won or he had it stolen. A number of speakers were pushing the big lie about the election, that Trump actually won, that sort of thing. And so, you kind of wonder, it wasn't all that different, really. If you'd been in a coma for a number of months and woke up in time for a CPAC, you would have thought that Trump won the election, no problem. And
yeah,
he was starting his second term. And so You know, that part of it to me was strange, just sort of the unreality of it. But I can't say I'm totally surprised, because, you know, it became clear after the insurrection that the Republican base was sticking with Trump. And so, you know, I think what you've seen since then has kind of been a logical consequence of that reality where, you know, Mitch McConnell, Lindsey Graham, you know, McConnell maybe a little bit less so, but Lindsey Graham, Jim Jordan, these people, you know, to a degree, they're scared of the base. They can't, you know, they feel like they can't cross the base, because if they did, it would be a death sentence for them politically. And so you see them, you know, still being all in on Trumpism even after Trump was solidly defeated in November. So it was very strange, but, you know, I can't say ultimately I was that surprised by it.
No, but you mentioned, okay, the night of the insurrection, on the night of January 6th, after they come back into the chamber, because they have to show the terrorists didn't win, we're going to get the work done, we're going to certify this election, and Lindsey Graham, I've said this a few times, I think, obviously, he found his stash of booze that he downed a bit before he went back on the floor, and a somewhat inebriated Lindsey said, "I'm done. I'm out. I had enough. I was with him, but this is enough. We can't do it anymore." I'm telling you, I almost was brought to tears that night, because I'm like, finally, finally, this is over. He's seeing it. He's calling it out. And then 2 days later, he's flying down to Florida to, you know, as I so, you know, eloquently put it, suck the mushroom dick of Donald Trump. I just can't. Like, what the hell? Mitch McConnell votes to acquit him in the impeachment trial, but then makes this speech of saying that he brought this all on. It's him. He's responsible. It's all his doing. We can't have this anymore. And then he says just the other day, if he's the 2020 nominee, sure, absolutely, I'll support him. Does Trump have like a private investigator on all these guys and the pictures of Lindsey Graham that we've known were out there for years that just nobody else has seen yet?
Oh, if it's that, or if it's just that, you know, I think Trump is still overwhelmingly the most popular Republican nationally and with the Republican base. And so, I mean, I think Mitch McConnell, you know, has been really a fascinating character because, you know, as you mentioned, he votes for acquittal and then turns around immediately after that and basically gives the de-Trumpification speech, you know, sort of harken back to the Khrushchev speech denouncing Stalin almost, you know, right, blaming him for the insurrection and, you know, kind of putting him on blast. And then, you know, a week later, he's on Fox News, as you mentioned, saying that he'll support Trump if he's the 2020 nominee. So you kind of see the triangulation that some of these Republicans are resorting to at this point where, you know, McConnell, his name was mentioned one time that I can remember at CPAC. And I think by Trump, actually, during his speech, and he was booed. And so, you know, that kind of shows you, you know, CPAC isn't entirely representative, I wouldn't say, of the Republican base, but it's the most activist kind of grassroots part of the Republican base. And, you know, they're still 100% aboard the Trump train. And, you know, if that requires viewing Mitch McConnell and Liz Cheney and those types as the enemy, then so be it. I mean, the one thing that you saw between all of the different speakers at CPAC, with maybe one exception, and I think the exception was not during a speech that was, you know, on the main stage, one of the ones that got a lot of media attention, but the one constant was that nobody crossed Trump. Nobody criticized right. Trump. You know, that was kind of the prerequisite for even getting a platform at CPAC. And so, you know, that's kind of the one through line. There really aren't a lot of policies that you know, came to the fore at CPAC other than railing against cancel culture and then kind of, you know, vague criticisms of what Biden is doing with immigration, not building the wall, open borders, the same sort of fear mongering that Trump, of course, campaigned on in 2015 and 2016. So nothing really new there. But, you know, of course, they didn't have a platform last year either, you know, coming out of the RNC. So this isn't a new thing. But, you know, I think the dynamic that's kind of fascinating is that, you know, we saw a fairly resounding repudiation of Trump last November, you know, losing by 8 million votes, losing decisively in the Electoral College. And now, you know, even today, as I'm speaking with you, just a bit ago, Biden gave a speech, you know, announcing that he's the country's 2 months ahead of schedule in terms of vaccine rollout.
Right.
Pretty much everybody who wants a vaccine shot should be able to get one by the end of May. And so you know, I just wonder, you know, if things kind of continue down that path and we have a summer, you know, where things are kind of rebounding from this horrible year that we've all just endured. I just don't really see how kind of doubling down on Trumpism is going to be a winning plan for Republicans. Of course, you know, there are some structural advantages being the party that's out of power going into a midterm election. And historically, you know, past as president, they'll pick up as precedent, they'll pick up some seats and maybe, you know, control of the House possibly. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the problem for them is that, you know, I just don't think, you know, you look at Biden's approval, it's in the high 50s, low 60s. Trump could never, you know, break 45%. And so, you know, Trump may be very popular still with the Republican base, but the Republican base is not sufficient to win elections nationally. And so, to me, you know, not to overuse the poker analogies, but it's a little bit of, I guess this would be a blackjack analogy, you know, doubling down on a losing hand.
Right.
It's like they don't really have a very good hand, but it's kind of the best that they can do. Because, again, if you cross Trump, you know, if you go the Liz Cheney route and say, I don't think he's the future of the party. I think what he did, you know, with the insurrection was a violation of his oath of office and therefore he should be impeached. You know, there doesn't really seem to be a future for those types of people in the Republican Party. And I think CPAC made that very, very clear.
Right. But, you know, there were also signs that for anybody who cared to look a little deeper, yes, Trump dominated the straw poll, but what, he only got like 55%, which, I'm sorry, in Trumpian terms, he should have been up at around 85, 90, right? And the fact that the room wasn't even full for his speech, there, it looks like there are some cracks in the armor there is all I can say. Now, ridiculously, the second place finisher in the straw poll was, yeah, I'm in Florida, by the way, the governor who we have renamed Moron Death Sentence instead of Ron DeSantis because it fits him better. He's in second place. Now, I guess part of that is because it was in Florida and these were his people. But really? And so now his insanity has gone on to Texas. Greg Abbott today says come Wednesday, the state's open at 100% and no more masks. And then the governor of Mississippi said, yeah, we'll do that, too. Is it just them saying we're not going to listen to anything those damn Democrats tell us? We're going to do the opposite because we're big and strong, tough guys. I just don't get any of it.
I think the Florida situation is actually quite fascinating. And I'm in the very early stages of doing some reporting on this because I do kind of want to get to the bottom of, you know, exactly what has gone on with the COVID response in Florida, because, you know, you look in terms of the state by state mortality and obviously, you know, New York is higher. New Jersey mm-hmm. is higher. You know, there are a lot of states that are higher than Florida, which has taken a relatively laissez-faire approach towards the pandemic, especially with a lot of businesses being open.
Yep.
You know, a lot of TV productions, things like that have moved to Florida because they've been able to do that without having restrictions there that, you know, cause them to have to shut down or, you know, make it unfeasible for them to operate. So, you know, I do think that that's about as strong of a hand as you're going to find among these Republican contenders in terms of having an actual resume to run on. I mean, you know, another thing I wrote about for Vox was the speech that Kristi Noem gave headlining on Saturday at CPAC. And, you know, it was very interesting because she gave the speech on Saturday, basically trying to take a victory lap kind of in the mold of a DeSantis saying, right, you know, look, our COVID response was a huge success and we didn't listen to Fauci. Isn't he wrong about everything and that sort of thing? And, you know, it was a big hit at CPAC. But then the next day she went on CBS
Face the Nation.
And,
yeah.
Asked kind of very basic questions, really didn't have much of a response. I mean, you know, the host, Margaret Brennan, pointed out to Noem that since July, South Dakota has had the highest mortality rates of any state in the whole country. And, you know, just kind of, you know, recited facts to her about how bad things have been in South Dakota. And, you know, Noem kind of resorted to whataboutism.
Yep.
You know, what about Cuomo?
That's a question you should be asking every governor. And Margaret right. Brennan said, yeah, but I'm asking you. And of course, you wouldn't answer. And because that's what they do. They don't answer questions and they deflect. Right.
So, but my point simply being that it does seem like, you know, if we're looking at COVID specifically, I mean, you know, I've gotten a sense that DeSantis and the government in Florida hasn't been super transparent all the time with data about what's going on.
That's one way to say it.
Of course, right. We've all seen the video a few months ago of the women who worked for, you know, the state.
Rebecca Jones.
Having her home invaded, basically, because she was posting unauthorized data online about COVID there. So that's kind of what I would love to get to the bottom of, is just exactly, you know, to what extent DeSantis can actually, you know, legitimately take some sort of victory lap over this. But, you know, I do think the approach that he's taken kind of embodies the way that the right would like to view itself, you know, kind of this notion that, look, government gets in the way and we were better off here just kind of, you know, having personal responsibility and not shutting anything down. And that's really the way that we should go. And so, you know, I can see how that resonates among Republicans. And so I'm not surprised that DeSantis, you know, polled number two. You know, the one thing I will mention with the CPAC straw poll that I thought was kind of interesting is that if you look at the names that were polled, the one poll that included Trump did not include any of his children. There was no Ivanka Trump. No, there was no Donald Trump Jr. So I'm not sure if that was an intentional thing to kind of save, you know, to kind of save some strife, you know, not pull these Trumps against one another. I don't believe the Trump children were actually included in the other poll that did not include Donald Trump as well. So that was kind of a variable that I would have been interested to see, you know, sort of where Donald Trump Jr., for instance, would stack up relative to DeSantis. But so, you know, my kind of big picture sense of where things are going from here is that I think we're going to see Trump, as he's alluded to, campaign for the Trumpy candidates in the midterms, kind of see how that goes. And if it ends up being a good cycle for Republicans, I think he'll kind of try and ride that wave into his own campaign for 2024. And I think if it goes poorly, that'll give him kind of an easy out to say, you know, I'm not going to run this time. And then it'll really be chaos to see, you know, who ends up emerging if it's a bad year next year for Republicans. But, you know, that all indications to me are that that's the way that Trump is going to play his hand from here.
Wow. And it just, it makes me not even want to just, I just want to go away to a beach somewhere, you know, just like get away from this. I thought we were done with him because at least in my lifetime, I don't recall a losing presidential candidate ever still retaining the, you know, the titular head of the party that they just lost the election for. It just doesn't make sense, but nothing they do makes sense. So this morning, Christopher Wray, director of the FBI, is testifying before the Senate Judiciary Committee about what happened on January 6th. CNN's covering it live. MSNBC is covering it live. Fox, and I learned this from you, Aaron Rupar, from your Twitter feed, is having a discussion on the cancellation of Dr. Seuss. And they're blaming it on Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats. And it had nothing to do with Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats. Ooh. It was Dr. Seuss Enterprises said, you know what? This has been an ongoing thing. Times change. We've been going through all our titles. We realize some of them are, you know, outdated, outmoded, and really unsuitable anymore. And I read off a couple of examples of what they were, and they made the decision to pull six titles. How many times have Fox been on this all day today? What?
Well, it's a nice segue from CPAC because, you know, a big theme of CPAC was cancel culture. And that's the way that this was framed all day on Fox. And, you know, I wish I could cite a specific number for you. I actually wrote kind of a big, long article on Vox.com about this because it really got to the point where it was almost like I felt like they were trolling people on Fox News with how much. I mean, every hour they were devoting like a full panel discussion to this. And, you know, it was one of the top stories all day. You know, meanwhile, Congress is debating a $2 trillion COVID relief package, and there's all this news about vaccines and
Christopher Wray and the Supreme Court. And, right. Stuff is happening today.
And it's just unbelievable. And, you know, again, I mean, no one should really be surprised by this. I mean, this is kind of Fox's business model is kind of stoking right wing grievance. And this, you know, this was their signature move, of course, during the Obama years. And so, you know, they've kind of very much reverted back to the tone of coverage, you know, the tan suit scandal sort of stuff, you know, now that they're done running interference for Trump all the time and doing interviews twice an hour with Trump administration officials and that sort of thing. But I mean, you're absolutely right in terms of kind of the TikTok of what happened with the Dr. Seuss stuff. I mean, the long and short of it is that the company that runs, you know, that kind of manages the Dr. Seuss portfolio, as you mentioned, decided to cease publication of six titles. that kind of trafficked in, you know, Orientalist tropes and anti-blackness. And so, you know, it's one of those things where I don't think that this necessarily negates the entire Dr. Seuss catalog.
No, you know, not at all.
As somewhat, yeah, I mean, you know, somewhat progressive and, you know, a lot of his political commentary was, you know, very much ahead of its time or to the left of his time. And so,
absolutely.
You know, I saw people kind of surfacing some of that today as these Republicans, you know, kind of wield him as a cudgel to attack the woke mob libs, so to speak. But, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, whenever we look back 50, 60, 70 years in culture with the standards of today, you know, there's going to be a lot of ways in which works of culture, works of art from decades, you know, decades in the past will fall short of today's standards. And I don't think anybody should necessarily be surprised by that. And, you know, I don't think it's a travesty that people are kind of reassessing books, you know, from the boomer era, you know, and making decisions about which ones are appropriate to continue publishing and which ones aren't. And, you know, again, I mean, the long and short of it is it's not like this is some sort of government mandate
right.
telling this publishing house to cease publication. It's not like this publishing house was under extreme pressure from liberals boycotting it or something like that, waging some sort of pressure campaign. It was just a decision that they made like any other business would make. But, you know, Fox News and the Fox News viewership kind of views this as the libs telling them that they're racist and deplorable. And so we get a day of, you know, people getting performatively mad about it. But, you know, the thing that's especially absurd, as I mentioned, is that there's all this stuff going on that they could be covering, and yet they're devoting 15 minutes out of every hour today to Dr. Seuss. And so, you know, it really is kind of beyond parody, to use a phrase that I often use on Twitter. But again, you know, we shouldn't be surprised. This is what Fox News does. But I just thought today was an especially egregious example and kind of an illustration of how, to another phrase that I've used at times to, about Fox News is that it's news adjacent propaganda. You know, there's usually some loose connection with the news, but it's always kind of, you know, it has an axe to grind. It's always informed by some sort of agenda that's just below the surface. And so today was an especially stark illustration of that.
You know, Aaron, you'd probably appreciate this. I had this made up many years ago. It's nothing new. I've offered it to Fox because, you know, they could use some juicing up on their imaging, you know, their on-air imaging packaging. But to this day, they still haven't taken me up on my offer. I'd give it to them free of charge. It's so perfect for what they do.
Your original source for fake news. Fox News. We make shit up.
It's what they do, and they've done it. And believe me, that has been around longer than Donald Trump and his fake news trope, because they are the original home for fake news. They've been making shit up for years. This is their business model. But the thing that I find so egregious about this whole Dr. Seuss thing is it had nothing to do with Congress, with the Democrats, with Pelosi or whoever else they're trying to push it on. This was Dr. Seuss Enterprises who decided to do this. And why it's a political thing now, it just is astounding how they make shit up. One perfect example this morning, They have an interview with Madison Cawthorn. Madison Cawthorn, one of their freshmen from North Carolina, who is the youngest member of Congress, who is in a wheelchair. He's paralyzed from the waist down. And now we're learning that every single thing about his story is a lie. All this is coming to light. He says, you know, he was in a car accident with his best friend. He was unconscious in the car. His friend left him for dead. He had been pronounced dead, and then he came back. It's all lies. His friend is the one who pulled him out of the burning car. He was never pronounced dead. He was incapacitated. But that whole story is a lie. He went to not Liberty University, but one of those kind of schools where he got all D's.
Trinity,
Trinity, and then dropped out. I mean, everything about him is manufactured lie. And they have him on Fox. And what did they choose to talk to him about? Dr. Seuss and how Nancy Pelosi and the Dems are trying to cancel Dr. Seuss. I just want the fact that they call themselves news, I find offensive.
Well, and this is and two things on that. I mean, one is that they've been spending a week castigating news outlets for not covering the Cuomo allegations, right. Which is, you know, fair enough. But then you turn around and you have a member of Congress who, you know, two huge in-depth reports with dozens of sources.
Right. And I left out the sexual allegations against him. Of course, that's a big part of the story.
And then, you know, the other thing, just kind of the broader thing on Fox News is that, you know, I kind of got into watching Fox News heavily during the Trump years when there was a lot of news on there. Trump would be calling in. You know, Peter Navarro would be on there. All of these administrations, you know, Kellyanne Conway was on there almost every day. Right. Sort of thing. And now, you know, it's just such a it's fallen so far from that in terms of newsworthiness. I mean, it's almost kind of like comedy, you know, like today with this Dr. Seuss stuff. And so, you know, that might lead to some kind of recalibration for me. I mean, you know, I do think it's important to know what's going on, you know, in the right wing and what people are talking about, because that stuff does percolate up. I mean, even today on the House floor, Kevin McCarthy gave a speech where he was decrying the cancellation of Dr. Seuss.
I played it.
Cancellation.
Yep.
So, I mean, you know, so it's important to know where these things come from. But, you know, it just is not, you know, it's not what it was during the Trump years when it really was, for better or worse, and mostly for worse, you know, kind of a vital source of information for what was going on with the executive branch. And, you know, they've gone from having these like really, you know, kind of noteworthy interviews with policymakers and very important officials from the administration to crying all day about Dr. Seuss, you know, within just a few months. So it's kind of a, you know, it's sort of a shocking turn of events for Fox.
Yeah. But now I don't know if it was you who noted it or some others, but it wasn't only Fox. Newsmax, I guess they just take their lead from Fox, also has been all over this non-story Dr. Seuss stuff all day today.
Well, right, because I looked at the transcripts this morning. Yeah, we have a service that pulls all of the transcripts from all the shows. And yeah, the Newsmax, they have it's called This American Morning, I think, or something like that. It's like their 2-hour morning show where Dr. Seuss is mentioned like 24 times, you know, during the show. And COVID was mentioned like 8 times.
Oh, my God.
You know, so that kind of gives you a sense. I mean, Newsmax is even Newsmax is like kind of Fox News on steroids. You know, it's like even the more Trumpy version of Fox. They're kind of outflanking Fox, you know, on the Trumpy side of things at this point. So, you know, I sometimes dip into there to see if like the MyPillow guy is on there, or Trump actually called in last week when Rush Limbaugh died for an interview, that sort of thing. I don't typically watch it, but today when I saw how Fox was handling this Dr. Seuss story, I just had to look and see, you know, if it was getting similar play on Newsmax. And it was even like twice as much of a topic on Newsmax. So, you know, if that gives you any idea of what's going on there, you know, they're even further out there than Fox at this point.
And the thing that's astounding, it's not even like it's a slow news day. It's not like there's nothing else for them to cover. They're just grasping at shit to inflame their, you know, highly uneducated people, I guess, that Donald Trump always loved. Again, it's astounding. So, Aaron Rupar, I so appreciate the fact that you sift through hours and hours of the crap they put out on the air and post it on Twitter. You help me immeasurably in this show because I work alone, so I don't have a producer to pull audio clips for me. And, you know, if there's ever something batshit crazy that goes on Fox, I know I can usually find it on your Twitter feed. So I thank you for doing that. I wonder how you keep your sanity. I know you've got an adorable little baby girl who we get to see on Twitter. Is that what keeps you sane? How do you separate the nuts from life? How do you go through it without it affecting you horribly?
You know, I probably have some PTSD from all of these years of just total immersion in Fox, but I've always kind of viewed it as like a fascinating, you know, it's like there's a lot of news being made. And so, you know, politics in America for the last, you know, dozen or so years, maybe a little bit less than that, certainly since Trump came onto the scene, has been pretty bleak.
Yeah.
And so, you know, Fox kind of, you know, Fox maybe is especially stark in terms of being an example of how bleak our politics is. But, you know, I always have felt kind of fortunate to be able to cover really interesting and historic stuff. And so, you know, I don't feel too burdened by it. You know, it has been kind of nice, at least these days, to not be worrying so much what the president is up to, you know, about the next unhinged call-in interview with Maria Bartiromo or what tweet is going to be posted at 11 p.m., you know, that's going to be kind of an all-hands-on-deck announcing, you know, banning transgender people from the military or something like that on Twitter in the dead of night. So, so that's been kind of a relief. And, you know, I hope that we're kind of trending in a more sane direction now, and that these conversations that, like, you and I have just had about Dr. Seuss, that these are kind of, you know, more of the fringe a fringe element more than the mainstream. But, you know, Fox still does have many millions of viewers, and it represents an important part of the Republican base, as did CPAC. And so, you know, I've never really been one that's kind of bought into, you know, when people say kind of tune it out, ignore it. I can understand why people say that, but I also think it's important to know what's going on the American right. And so I find my job to be interesting in that respect. And so I feel fortunate to be able to make a living doing it.
Well, we thank you for doing it, because you help us know without us having to actually watch. I cannot physically turn the TV tuner to Fox. My hand suffers like Laffy's tendonitis if I try. It won't allow me. So I appreciate you. Aaron Rupar, find him at Vox.com and AT Rupar on the Twitters. Thank you so much for joining us today. It was great to meet you. Really appreciate it. You take care. Bye. Tomorrow's Wednesday. I may need a day off. I'm not sure. We'll see. To be continued tomorrow or the day after, I guess. Go read some Dr. Seuss. Okay? All right. Bye. Ah, I can give you what's news. I forgot. I got what's news here. Let's do it.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
On Tuesday, the Supreme Court hears two cases that could kill what's left of the Voting Rights Act. Vox.com's Ian Millhiser explains.
The argument in these two cases on Tuesday, it's a Brnovich v. Democratic National Committee and Arizona Republican Party v. Democratic National Committee are the two cases. And these cases could really stick the dagger in the wall. I mean, I don't think that the Supreme Court is going to say that the Voting Rights Act is unconstitutional, but what I think it is fairly likely to do is to water down the Voting Rights Act so much that it just becomes meaningless. You know, it becomes almost impossible to win a voting rights case. And then states will be free to engage in really widespread racist voter discrimination in order to prevent black people from voting, to prevent brown people from voting. And of course, really what's going on here is to prevent Democrats from voting.
So the laws concern strict requirements to vote in a specific precinct and who can handle the ballots. Voting rights advocates fear that the court's conservative majority could set new and stricter voting precedents. After Donald Trump's repeated baseless claims of voter fraud after the 2020 elections, state lawmakers have carried over or introduced at least 253 bills to restrict voting access in 43 states. Although the cases are being heard on Tuesday, a decision isn't expected until probably June. FBI Director Christopher Wray, testifying before the Senate Judiciary Committee Tuesday morning on the Bureau's response to various threats after the January 6th insurrection. More officials will testify Wednesday, including the commanding general of the D.C. National Guard, along with several civilian officials from the Department of Defense, FBI, and Department of Homeland Security. And then there were three. No, I'm not talking about the third COVID-19 vaccine, that one, you know, from Johnson & Johnson, being approved and beginning to be delivered. Nope. I'm talking about a third woman who's come forward to accuse New York Governor Andrew Cuomo of harassment. In an interview with the New York Times on Monday, Anna Roosh said she met Cuomo at a wedding reception in September of 2019 and that he made unwanted advances, starting with placing his hand on her bare lower back. Roosh said she removed his hand, but Cuomo then placed his hands on her cheeks, on her face, and loudly asked if he could kiss her before she pulled away. It was just last week that two former Cuomo aides accused him of sexual harassment. On Sunday, the governor said in a statement that some of his remarks may have, quote, been misinterpreted as an unwanted flirtation. Huh? New York Attorney General Letitia James is working on selecting an outside investigator to review the allegations. The Biden administration is working to give families separated at the U.S.-Mexico border a chance to reunite in the United States or in their country of origin. The newly confirmed and installed Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas said on Monday, quote, if in fact they seek to reunite here in the U.S., we will explore lawful pathways for them to remain in the U.S. and to address the family needs, so we are acting as restoratively as possible. President Biden issued an executive order this month establishing a task force to look into bringing the families back together. Under the former guy, the U.S. separated around 2,800 families in 2018, and around 550 children continued to await reunification. Mayorkas said the Biden administration has brought 105 families together so far. The Senate on Monday confirmed Miguel Cardona, Connecticut's Commissioner of Education, to be President Biden's Secretary of Education. The 45-year-old Cardona has also worked as a teacher, principal, and administrator. Two of his biggest challenges in the job will be guiding schools as they make plans to reopen and managing the government's $1.5 trillion student loan portfolio. During his confirmation hearing, Cardona said he would also focus on the inequities in the country's education system because unless they're tackled head on, he said, they will prevent the potential of this great country. Well, the director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention on Monday warned states against rolling back COVID-19 restrictions too soon for fear it could result in yet another resurgence of infections. Dr. Rochelle Walensky said that data suggests recent declines in daily coronavirus cases have, quote, leveled off at a very high number and appear to be stalling at about 70,000 a day. At this level of cases with variants spreading, she said, we stand to completely lose the hard-earned ground we have gained. Again, this warning came as Johnson & Johnson begins shipping the first doses of its coronavirus vaccine, which was just approved for emergency use. The approval added a third vaccine to the campaign to step up inoculations in the U.S. after a decidedly slow start. And this weird bit of news around the vaccine, like everything with the former guy, this is just weird. We're now learning that then President Trump and his first lady quietly received the COVID-19 vaccine in January, just before they left the White House for good. As to why the secrecy? Who knows? Other leaders have publicized their vaccines as a way to encourage Americans to sign up for the shot when it's available to them. And finally, it's done elsewhere. Former French President Nicolas Sarkozy has been sentenced to 3 years in prison for corruption and influence peddling. A French court found him guilty of trying to illegally obtain information from a senior magistrate in 2014 about an ongoing investigation into his campaign finances. Sarkozy was president from 2007 to 2012 and is the first president to be sentenced to jail in France's modern history, but he won't actually see the inside of a jail cell. The court suspended 2 years of the sentence, and the judge said the 66-year-old can serve the rest of the time by wearing an electronic bracelet at home. So much for equal justice under the law. I got the news. And that's just a bit of what's news for now. I'm Nicole Sandler. If you appreciate these reports and the Nicole Sandler Show, I hope you'll consider making a contribution. My work is 100% listener supported, and I can't do it without your help. Find out more at NicoleSandler.com, and please click on that donate button.